Access number 12571, Real 1.
Admiral Heslett, Real 1. Could you tell me, please, what you were doing when war was declared in September 1939, please?
I was First Lieutenant of the submarine Trident, building at Camel Laird's in Birkenhead.
How did you feel about the war declaration? What was your personal reaction to it?
Well, it was pretty obviously coming over a period of years, and it was really a question of when. I don't know. As a professional, I can't say that I was altogether dismayed. One always has a feeling that you want to put your training to full use. The attitude in the country, from my memory, was pretty somber but pretty determined. And I don't remember any sort of demonstrations of anti-war stuff at all on the outbreak of war. Some years before, there was a certain amount of pacifist propaganda, especially among intellectuals, but not on the outbreak.
What had you personally thought at that time about Britain's prospects against Germany? Did you think we were going to win?
We hadn't got quite such a view of the strength of Germany as we afterwards had after the war broke out, I don't think. From a naval point of view, of course, we were hugely superior, and we felt that fairly secure, I think. I mean, the Navy was very, very big compared to Germany.
What happened to you in your personal career standing by the building of Trident? What happened next?
Well, the submarine's completion was accelerated by about a month. She was about 3 months off completion. But we got her going. Camel Laird sped up everything, and we completed it about a month early. And we then went from Birkenhead up to the Clyde for very rapid trials. And we were out on patrol before the end of 1939.
Whereabouts?
Well, the first patrol we did was off the west coast of Ireland. It was an anti-U-boat one. At that time, there was an idea among the naval authorities that submarines were very apt to come into bays to replenish and things. We now know this to have been complete nonsense. Submarines have huge range and have no need to do this whatever. But we put a patrol off Blacksod Bay in the west of Ireland, funnily enough, and there was another submarine off St Kilda. Anti-submarine patrols. That was our first patrol, and we then went round to Rosyth and joined in as an operational submarine in the North Sea.
What did you think of this new submarine?
Well, now, I don't know how much you know about submarine construction policy, but after the First World War, we produced new submarines, mainly for the Far East, where we'd found our North Sea boats in the First World War were quite far too small and of too little endurance. And we produced a number of submarines of greatly increased habitability and endurance. Now, these submarines were, they all fought in the Second World War, but they had a number of things wrong with them. They didn't achieve any of their desired requirements. They didn't achieve their diving depth, they didn't achieve their full speed, and many things like that. And above all, they had external fuel tanks, which we'd copied from the German U-boats, which tended to leak. And, of course, the worst thing you can have in a submarine is a leaky fuel tank. These were totally replaced by welded tanks before the war broke out. But the new submarines of the T-class were designed to be above all reliable and to overcome the difficulties of this class of OP&R class that had been started early in the war. And they had the same endurance as the OP&R class, but were very much reliable, and all their fuel was inside. This was really it. At the same time, they had been given a very substantial torpedo armament, which it was considered was necessary because they were believed they would have to fire at long range because of ASDICs or possible echo detection. And they therefore need a large number of torpedoes to achieve any results. So the T-class had 10 torpedo tubes, and this was really the main thing about them. We were on the first trial, very impressed with the boat. She dived in the gearlock for the first time, and she, I thought, handled beautifully. And we were very happy with her. Mind you, having said that, we just had the Thetis disaster, and the Trident was a sister ship to the Thetis. There was, as we went for the dive, we were the next submarine after the Thetis to do trials from Camel Lairds. And there was apprehension, without any question, among the Camel Lairds personnel who were wondering whether it would go all right. We were extremely careful to make sure everything did go right, and it went perfectly. And you could see the morale change after the first dive in the most remarkable way. The T-class were an extraordinarily reliable but unimpressive from a performance point of view. They were not particularly fast, they hadn't a particularly deep diving depth, but they were jolly good, reliable boats.
What happened on your North Sea patrols?
Well, at first, the North Sea was... you see, the Germans were really confined down to a little coastline behind Heligoland, and the rest were neutral countries. Our principal aim in those days was to stop Graf Spee or Scheer or Scharnhorst and Eisenhower getting out into the Atlantic and to try and cut down their U-boats going to and fro. At the same time, Winston Churchill in the spring of 1940 started to say we must do something about the iron ore traffic from Narvik down to Germany. But this was not easy to do because at the time we were operating entirely in accordance with the international law, which meant you weren't allowed to sink merchant ships without warning. You had to visit and search them and send them in if they had contraband and that sort of thing, which made it quite impracticable. So those were our operations until the April 1940 in the Norwegian campaign, when of course the whole situation changed fundamentally.
What did you do?
Well, we were sent on patrol at the end of March before the Norwegian campaign was known about. And we were actually out on patrol when everybody realized that an invasion was possible, and we put the finishing touches to our mine-laying operations, which were to try and stop the traffic coming down the Norwegian coast. And these two operations, the British and the German, as you know, happened simultaneously. Now, we knew nothing whatever about this, and we were in the Skagerrak, off Oslo Fjord, actually, on the day the invasion actually began of Norway. And we saw this procession of German ships which were sent up the coast in advance inside Swedish and Norwegian territorial waters so that we couldn't get at them. But in my view, obviously German, going up the coast, and we were very puzzled by this. And then, on the 8th of April, one of these German ships, a tanker called the Posidonia, with no markings, no ensign, looking like the Altmark, which had been the tender to the Graf Spee, cut the corner across a bay and left Swedish territorial waters to cross the bay into Norwegian territorial waters and came into the open sea for a brief few miles. And we managed to pop to the surface and order him to stop because we were dissatisfied with what he was. And he immediately scuttled and abandoned ship. So we hastened his end with the torpedo, and that was a tanker called the Posidonia, which was on her way to Bergen with fuel for the German ships, as I understand it. We took two prisoners, and but we still had no idea that the Norwegian invasion was about to take place.
What happened next?
Well, that night, signals showed us the invasion force was coming up from the Skaw towards Oslo. But unfortunately, we were moved to a place called Larvik, which is just to one side of Oslo Fjord, because the flag officer submarines, with very good reason, reckoned the Germans would land there. There's a railway from there to Oslo, and it looked militarily a sensible thing to do, rather than to try and force the fairly heavy coast defences of Oslo Fjord. In fact, the Germans went for the defences and lost the Blücher in doing so, as you probably know. And so we missed them in the night. And we then realized that the invasion of Norway was taking place. And I may say we were just as quick as the Admiralty in realizing this. As you probably know, the Admiralty were quite convinced that the first movements of the Scharnhorst and Eisenhower towards Narvik were a breakout into the Atlantic. And they didn't connected with an invasion of Norway until about the same time as we did.
And then?
We had been out for about a fortnight. We fired at one merchant ship after the restrictions on firing merchant ships were taken off, somewhere south of Norway, off the Naes roughly. And we were then recalled to Rosyth, mainly to get a second wave of submarines going. You can't have them all out all the time. You want some relief. So they called us back to replenish and everything, and we put to sea again later.
Why was the... What was the policy about taking prisoners? You said you took two prisoners.
Yes. I don't recall there being any particular policy. We thought it was a good thing to... It would yield us information, I suppose. And we took one officer prisoner who we thought was the master. I don't believe he was, actually. And the rest were in the boats and quite close to the Norwegian coast.
What was their demeanour aboard? Did they
talk? Well, they looked very upset, obviously. Their mission had clearly failed, but they weren't naval personnel, as far as I know. They were merchant seamen.
Did they say anything?
Well, we, unfortunately, had no German speakers, and we weren't able to interrogate them, and they weren't interrogated till we got back, back to Rosyth.
What happened to you next?
The next patrol, if I remember rightly, was off in the Bergen area, where we were stationed to try and stop the German traffic going up the outer coast. In fact, the Germans had decided to route most of their traffic straight across the Skagerrak to Oslo, and not to come up the outside. And in any case, if they had done so, they would have been inside the islands, which would have been difficult to get at. My captain, I was the first lieutenant, don't forget, and mainly engaged in internal matters in the submarine and not the strategy and so on, but my captain decided he was going to try and go inside the islands. And he dived into Korsfjord, south of Bergen, to take up a position in the inner route. We stayed one whole night there and charged. And next day a ship came along, and he missed it with torpedoes, and then surfaced and drove it ashore with the gun. It was a ship called the Claire Hugo Stinnes, a German ship. And we then felt pretty vulnerable in broad daylight in the middle of Norway and made for the open sea on the surface down Korsfjord. And we were pursued by two small, I think they were R boats, what the Germans called our boats, patrol boats. And we dived and were depth charged by them. That's about all, I think. It was a very early... It was the first time we'd ever run into opposition. We were very nervous that any noise of any machinery at all would give us away. In fact, this was not really so, we found out afterwards, but we were very frightened of making any noise. And as a result, the captain was saying, don't pump, don't blow, don't do anything. And of course, if you don't do anything in the submarine does what it wants. And we dived extremely deep. We went well below our depth, of our tested depth. And we then had to do something. And the captain decided the most silent thing he could do was to put air into the main ballast tanks. And, of course, this makes you very unstable, because if you come up, the air expands and makes you lighter still. And, in fact, we lost control, and we came right up and broke surface right out. But the Germans had gone, to our great surprise. That was interesting, I think, because it was a way of learning experience. We knew, you see, the first 6 months of the phony war, very little happened in the North Sea. And one knew very little of how to compete with counterattacks and all that sort of thing.
Were there any special problems about being in northern waters for a submarine?
No, I don't think so. It was cold, of course, but there was no ice there. There was ice inside the Skagerrak, but we never encountered it. Some submarines did. It was liable to cause damage to torpedo tubes and to periscopes and things. But we were always on the outside, and there was no ice off Bergen or on the outside of Norway.
What happened in the rest of that patrol?
Not very much. We missed another ship outside, and that was about all that happened to us. But I just recalled, in the phony war period, it might interest you, that at the time when the Finns were invaded by Russia, there was a feeling that the Russians might push on into North Norway. There were also a lot of German ships in Murmansk who'd taken shelter there at the outbreak of war. And we were sent at the end of 39 right up to North Russia to sort of have a look and sniff there. And that was very, very cold. We were still in the Gulf Stream, again no ice, but constant darkness. It practically, you got a little, an hour or two of twilight, that's all. We did a patrol up there, which was interesting, but we saw nothing to speak of. But it did show that if necessary, a submarine could patrol up there. And of course, later in the war, they did so in considerable numbers.
After this Bergen patrol, did you continue to participate in the Norway campaign?
Yes, until the autumn. And the great difficulty in the Norwegian campaign at that time was the constant daylight. It wasn't constant. You got a few hours of darkness, but it wasn't sufficient to charge your batteries, to recharge your batteries. And there was this constant fear that if the enemy just, all they had to do was hang about and prevent you surfacing, and you could be hunted to exhaustion. That was the trouble of the Norway campaign. And, of course, we lost something like 6 submarines that summer.
Did you have any more successes in the Norway campaign?
No.
Any narrow escapes from depth charging or attack?
Only the one I have told you. The only other narrow escape we had were by RAF aircraft. We were bombed by a Hudson on one occasion. Which was liable to happen as you were coming back across the North Sea. It was terribly difficult to get really hard and fast bombing restrictions and so on that were really good. Position of the submarine was often in error, and the position of the aircraft also in error. There was one other case where I never realized it until some time afterwards, where I'm very certain that at night we were missed by a German submarine torpedo. I didn't realize this for some time afterwards, when I was actually on the torpedo range and heard the noise of a torpedo going underneath on the range and heard what it sounded like. And I'm quite certain we were near missed by a torpedoes south of Norway in, I suppose May 1940.
What happened to the Trident after the Norway campaign?
Well, I left her that autumn to go to the command course. I was trying to think. She stayed on as one of the North Sea operational boats for the next winter.
What was your own reaction to going into being prepared for command?
Oh, I was delighted. I thought this was a splendid business. The course was very, very on a shoestring at that time. I was first sent to Fort Blockhouse in at Gosport, where there was an attack teacher. And this was in the height of the Battle of Britain. And air raids were going on all the time. And we were given a series of attacks by Lieutenant Commander Steele, who was the what was known as the he was in charge of submarine commanding officer training at the time. And I suppose I did something like 30 attacks on the attack teacher on various targets, from the Scharnhorst to U-boats to all kinds of things. About 30 attacks. One evening, this is an anecdote which you might as well record. One evening I was in the mess and the commander came in and I was just standing in the wardroom doing nothing in particular, and he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Nothing, sir." And he said, "You've got the middle on the pom-pom." And I thought, what on earth does that mean? And I inquired, and there was a pom-pom gun mounted up in Fort Blockhouse on the corner facing down the channel. And, of course, mine-laying aircraft at that time were liable to come in and lay mines. And this pom-pom was there to try and prevent this. And so I went up there at midnight, and there were a collection of men who seemed to have been gathered from everywhere, who'd never seen a pom-pom before in their lives. And we found out how this thing worked. And in my watch, a air raid alarm went, and we heard a German bomber. German bombers were quite distinctive in those days. They had they made a quite different noise. And this was a German bomber coming down the channel, and we fair blazed away that night. I don't think we hit anything. We never saw the bomber. We just fired straight down the channel with this pom-pom gun. And I'm quite sure that Fort Blockhouse, which was first...